Greetings again on this nice rainy evening in the Gallatin Valley. You get to listen to the almost 1 hour long health and happiness program brought to you in part by contributions to the Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association. I am Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, along with Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech language pathologist. We are proud to be broadcasting on KGVM 95.9 FM and on KGVM.org. There, you can also listen to a plethora of past programs as well. You know, nothing could make one happier than to be welcomed to a community where you are moving. Tonight, Dr. Suzanne will now introduce one such person who has made a remarkable, successful move. Dr. Suzanne.
Good evening, everyone. We're so happy once again to follow up on our visit with the International Rescue Committee and the state senators involved with helping in those efforts for the new immigrants coming to Montana. But we really wanted to talk also just about immigrants in general. It might interest you to know that immigrant founded and owned companies and businesses employ 6 million people in the United States of America. 60% of the biggest tech companies were co-founded by first or second generation immigrants. That is 60%. For instance, Steve Jobs, a second generation Syrian, and Sergey Brin, a Russian immigrant, began some little websites you might be familiar with, like Google, and many others are brought to us by our immigrant friends. In fact, here's another good figure, 25% of all companies in the United States were founded by immigrants. Over 40% of businesses on the Fortune 500 list are launched by immigrants or children of immigrants. And all of this is amazing because only about 13% of the U.S. population is composed of immigrants. Tonight, we have a fantastic immigrant with us, Mayor Wilmot Collins of Helena, informally of Liberia. We can hardly wait to hear your story and to talk about your journeys. Welcome, Mayor Collins.
Thank you, Susan. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you all.
Well, tell us about yourself. How did all this come about?
Well, my parents. No. Well, I was born in...
Okay, let's start there with your parents. Along came Wilmot, and you were born in Liberia, is that correct?
That is correct. I was born in Liberia, raised in Liberia until I was about 31 years old before transitioning to this great state.
And how was the thinking, what was going on that brought you and your family to America?
Well, Liberia got engulfed in a brutal civil war. And the war started when, as a matter of fact, you know, Liberia was established by slaves that were freed from this country, the United States. The slaves went back to Africa and they landed in Liberia. They named it Liberia, free land. Liber in Latin is free. And they were used to things that they had learned from this country. Like the capital city was named in honor of James Monroe, Monrovia. We have places like Georgia, we have places like Louisiana, and my name is Collins. It's not an African. So, in fact, the largest rubber plantation in the world is the Firestone Plantation Company, where the U.S. get her Firestone tires, Bridgestone, B.F. Goodrich. All that material comes from Liberia. And so my parents worked for the company. My dad was a civil engineer. My mom was superintendent of schools. And we lived a middle class life. And things were okay until the president, William Talbot, who is a descendant from North Carolina. His parents were from North Carolina. He became president. He was also a Baptist minister, and he was president of the Baptist World Alliance. When he was president, he decided to establish diplomatic links with USSR. And we had our first civil uprising shortly after that. The president was killed, and the military took over. And Liberia, as we knew it, was done. When the military took over, when we talk about Liberia, we talk about a country that was exporting shrimp and exporting iron ore, exporting diamond, gold, timber. When the military took over, all of that went to a standstill. Corruption was at its highest. And people started getting missing. A lot of people fled the country. And one of those that fled the country was Charles Taylor. And he decided to come back to Liberia and take out the military government. And he brought in his rebel forces. And that's how the war started. And things got so terrible. A lot of people fled. I know eventually my wife and I fled the country, but prior to fleeing, we went through what they call to hell and back, because my wife was in medical school and I was a teacher at an international organization. And things got so bad, we fled from the medical dormitory to my home, to my sister's home, to her home. And finally, we fled into the area where the American embassy was. And at this point, we were out in the elements. We were out in the open. There was no home or anywhere for us to go. My mom, my sibling, my wife, and myself. And this lady recognized my mother and said, "Well, I have a room, but there's nothing in it. But at least you'll be out of the element, you know." So we took the room and we stayed in our room. And then we heard that West African countries were getting together a peacekeeping force to send to Liberia, because things had gone from bad to worse. I mean, the United Nations estimated 350,000 Liberians lost their lives in the first 3 months of the war.
Oh.
I lost two brothers in that war. Mm. And when the West African peacekeepers arrived, they told Liberians that if you want to leave Liberia, you can leave on board this cargo vessel that bring the soldiers, you know. And we had heard that the first cargo vessel left, and we heard there was a second one at the port. So that night, my mom, my brother, my sister, my wife, we all prayed about it. We said, yes, we think it's time we leave. But prior to making that decision, I remember we ran out of food. And my wife and I decided, at the time she was my fiance, we decided that we were going to look for food that day. And we searched from like 9 o'clock till 4 o'clock in the evening, didn't find anything. And we were going back home when we got stopped at one of the checkpoints, the last checkpoint before you get to where we were going. And the rebels called my wife and started to interrogate her. And then finally he asked her who, because I was just standing up. You don't say a word. I was just standing up watching. And he asked her, "Who is that? Is that your man?" And my wife said, "Yes." And he looked at both of us and said, "You're very lucky today. I'm done killing for the day. Get out of here." And we ran backwards because I was afraid we were going to get shot in the back. We ran backwards until we were out of sight. And then that's when we went to my mom and said, "It's time. I think we got to get out of here. We have to get out of here." And we prayed and prayed and prayed about it. The next morning, we got up and decided to go to the port where the ship had landed. And my mom said, "No, I'm not leaving." And I said, "Why aren't you leaving?" She said, "Well, I prayed some more and the Lord isn't leading me." I said, "Well, the Lord brought the ship." I tried to convince my mom, but she wouldn't budge. She was determined to stay. And I said, "Well, Mom, we got to go." She said, "Okay, go. God be with you." And she handed us $5. And we left. You know, Liberia also used the U.S. dollars as a medium of exchange. So we walked to the port. When we got to the port, it was a Friday. And the line to get on board the ship was so long. We stayed on line Friday. We stayed on line Saturday. We stayed on line Sunday. Finally, at 9:47 p.m., my wife and I were chosen to get on board the ship. We got on board that ship, and there was only standing room. Only standing room. So finally, I whispered to her, I said, "Where are we going?" She said, "I thought you knew." I said, "No, I don't." And so right there and then, we didn't even know where we were going when we got on board the ship. The next morning, we heard people crying. We started squeezing our way through to find out what was going on. Some people, loved ones, had died on board the ship, and they had to dump them overboard. And that was terrifying for me because I said, "Oh my God, maybe that's why my mom didn't want to come. She saw something we didn't see." Because my mom at the time was not too well. And so, but the first stop on the ship was 3 days journey. And the first stop would be in Ghana. And in Ghana, they speak English. And I told my wife we were going to an English country because most of our neighboring countries were French speakers. But when we heard it was going to go to Ghana, I told her, "We've got to get down in Ghana." And when they arrived in Ghana 3 days later, we disembarked, and I asked my wife for the $5. I said, "Hey, there is a branch in Ghana of the international organization that I used to teach at. They had a branch in Ghana." I said, "I have to find them to let them know, you know." And I stopped a cab, and I told the guy, "I only have $5. He said, "That's enough." Later on, we found out it would have cost us only 50 cents to get to where we wanted to go, to the SOS Children's Village. When we got to the village, I asked to speak to the director. And the director came and said, I introduced myself and told him I was from SOS Liberia. And he said, "Can you identify yourself?" And I said, "Yes, I'm Wilmot Collins." He said, "Do you have an ID?" I said, "No." For the first time, I could not prove I was Wilmot Collins, because in Liberia, we had to get rid of ID cards, because if you were caught, people tend to want to link you to something or someone. And it's almost a death sentence when you're being linked to something or someone. And so we all got rid of our IDs. But the director said, "Well, some kids from the village came on the first ship. If they can identify you, I'll help you." I said, "Sure, call them." And when he called them and when they saw me, they broke down crying. I was confused. I thought they would be happy to see me, but then they all were crying. And I asked to use the restroom for the first time. And when I went into the restroom and looked in the mirror and got on board this, I got on the scale in the restroom, I was 92 pounds. That's why they were crying. Hmm. When they knew me as their teacher, I was 175, 177 pounds. That day when they saw me, I was 92. My wife was 87.
Oh.
We were literally dying of starvation. So the director said, I'll help you. So we, he found lodging for us. We got in there and he put me back into the school. I started teaching in the school. My wife was a medical student, so she started helping out in the clinic. And after about 3 months, my wife came to me and said, you know, I'm very appreciative that we're here, but this is not what I want. So I said, what do you want? And she said, let's go to America. I said, how do you suppose we do that? She said, let's go to Montana. She said, let's go to Montana. I said, you got to make up your mind. We ought to go to America or go to Montana. She said, but Montana is in America. So that was the first time I heard of, you know, Montana, so to speak. And so I said, how do you suppose we go there? So she said, I have a whole family in Montana. Let me call them and see if they will help us. My wife was an African exchange student in the 80s. And she came to Montana. She graduated from Helena High along with Governor Bullock. They were classmates.
Oh my word.
Yes, the old man upstairs, the Lord works in mysterious ways. So, she called her host family, and her host family were willing to help us come to America, but they didn't know the process. We didn't know the process. And so we were at a loss. But they did not relent. They contacted Carroll College. And Carroll College awarded my wife a full scholarship to do nursing. And they put me on the scholarship as her dependent. And when we went to the embassy to get our visas to come to America, we were informed that only one of us would be able to come. And I looked at my wife. I said, well, you have the scholarship. You go. And so we told them that my wife had the scholarship and my wife would be the one leaving. And so they granted my wife a visa to come to America August 19th. She was supposed to leave Africa, Ghana, 1991. And about 2 weeks before her departure, she started to get really sick. We took her into the hospital. They ran tests and everything. And the doctor came out and said, congratulations, Mr. Collins, you'll soon be a proud father. And I'm like, no, my wife is going to school. He said, well, she's going to school pregnant. And then I told her, you know, by then I said, hey, I think we have to rethink your going, because I didn't mind you going alone, but now you're going with our child. You know, I don't ever know when I'll see you again. But she was convincing and said, this is the best for all of us. Let me go. So we decided, okay, you go. And she left, and she came, and she lived with Bruce and Joyce Noxheim, her host family, while she attended Carroll College. And in the meantime, I was in Ghana, and I decided I was going back to Liberia because things were not the same. And I went back to Liberia because there was a ceasefire. While I was in Liberia for about a month, the ceasefire broke. And this time, when I fled Liberia into the Ivory Coast. And in the Ivory Coast, they speak French. So that was very difficult. But in the meantime, Liberians in the U.S. have petitioned Congress, and Congress passed the Liberian Resettlement Act. And that act stated that if you had a relative in America who was an American citizen, who was a permanent resident, who had a green card, you were allowed to join your family. And I went to the embassy to find out whether I was eligible, and I was told no, because my wife was here as a student. In the meantime, they told me, well, since you have a wife, you can register as a refugee with the United Nations and go through the refugee process. And so that's what I did. And then my daughter was born. And then I went back to the embassy and told them, hey, I have a daughter in America who is an American. And they told me I had to prove that my daughter was my daughter. And that process was no joke. Mm. That process took me 2 years and 7 months to finally complete.
Oh.
Yes, 2 years and 7 months. I had to send letters to prove that my wife and I were still in touch. I had to send phone bills to prove that we were still in touch. She had to send the birth certificate. I mean, then we had to go through medical. Then we had to go through a series of interviews with the FBI and the State Department and immigration and the UN. I remember by the time I got to the fifth step in the process, I was done. The process was so invasive and so cumbersome. I just called my wife. I told her, I said, move on. Just move on. I don't think I'll ever come and join you. This process, I don't think I could ever go through it. And she said, you got to keep trying. God will provide a way. You keep trying. You keep trying. That's all you need to do. And so I kept trying and trying and trying. And finally, I got approved to join my family, but there was no departure date. And so I had a sister in New Jersey, and I called my sister up. I said, hey, would you go to Montana and visit my family? And she said, sure. She came to Montana 1993. And after she visited for 4 days, she went back to New Jersey, and I called her. I said, talk to me about Montana. How was it? She said, if you're coming to America, you're not going to Montana. I said, what do you mean? She said, I was there for 4 days, and it snowed for 4 days, and I didn't see any black people. So I don't know where you're going. I said, what do you mean, black people? I said, black people are all over the place. You know, I envision America as what we saw on TV. And she said, no, Montana is different. No black people there. I was there for 4 days. And so I became very concerned. I called my wife. I said, hey, I got approved to come. I don't know when I'm coming. But and when I called her, it was in January. I said, so what's Montana like? She said, oh, you will love it. It's beautiful. I said, what's the weather today? She said, oh, my God, it's pretty warm today. I said, what is it? She said, it's 29 degrees. I said, 29 as in what? Celsius or Fahrenheit? She said, Fahrenheit. I said, what do you mean it's warm at 29? Because water freezes at 32. How can it be warm at 29? And the average temperature in Liberia was 85. So I said, you must not know what you're talking about. So I said, let me talk to your host mom. So Joyce Noxine came on the phone. I said, hi, Joyce. I will be joining you all soon. She said, we're so excited you're coming. I said, Joyce, what's the weather like? She said, oh, my God, you won't believe it. It's so warm. I said, what's the temperature? She says, 29 today. And then I went silent. I said, Joyce, would you humor me and tell me, what is it when it's cold? So sometimes 30 below. I said, below what? She said, below zero. And I'm like, where am I going? And then my wife got back on the phone, and I said, has our daughter Jamie seen a black person? She said, oh, yeah, there is a black boy in my school. I said, did you just say a black boy? She said, yeah, why? I said, means there's only one. She said, oh, don't worry, she'll get used to you. I said, that's not the point. And so anyway, I went and checked at the embassy, and I was to leave. Finally, we got a date. I was to leave the Ivory Coast February 15th, arrived at JFK Airport February 16th evening, and then February 17th, I was to arrive, leave JFK, and come to Montana. And when we got to the airport, got on board the plane, and my sister, she called me up and said, when you arrive in JFK, I got a bag of clothing for you. Put every piece on before going to Montana. It's in the winter. So I said, okay. So arriving JFK, I met my sister. She handed me a bag of clothing. And the next morning, I'm dressing, and I see these long johns. And she had two sets in there. And she told me to put every piece on, so I decided to put on two sets of long johns. And I didn't know it was that difficult. You know, it's very difficult to put on two sets of long johns. But I put them on, and I got to the airport, and I'm looking around, and I'm the only person sweating in the airport. In the terminal, I was totally miserable. But I said, my sister knew what she was talking about. So we got on board the plane, and the first layover was in Salt Lake City. So we had to get out, and the layover was a few hours. So I ran in the restroom and pulled out some layers of clothing. And then I got back on the plane. And I was seated next to the window. And this gentleman came on the plane and sat next to me. And he said, you must be Wilmot. I almost died. I said, who are you? Who are you? He said, oh, I'm sorry. My name is Craig Baker. My parents were the one that awarded your wife the scholarship to do nursing at Carroll. I said, oh, my God, but how did you know I was Wilmot? He said, well, look around the plane. I looked around the plane. Okay. I was the only African-American on the plane. I said, but still, how did you know I was Wilmot? He said, oh, my parents told me you were coming. It's just that I didn't know we were going to be on the same plane. And so we're coming down to Helena, and then I heard the pilot get on the intercom. And so, welcome to Helena. It's sunny and warm at 32 degrees, and I am freaking out because it's 32 degrees, and he's talking about sunny and warm. And I had taken off some of my long johns, and I wanted to put them back on, but I wasn't allowed to stand up because we were descending, and I was scared. When we got down, everybody got off the plane. I tried going in the restroom to put on my long johns, but it was taking forever. So I got down, I descended and walked to the terminal. When I got into the terminal, I saw all the Carroll College professors, the president, everybody from all over Helena. They were there to meet me. No. And I was just looking at one person. My wife had her in her arm. This was the first time I'm seeing my daughter, and she's almost, she's 1 month shy of her second birthday. And my wife put her down and said, there is daddy, go to daddy. And because I didn't know her and she didn't know me, I stopped. I didn't want to startle her. And she came running and jumped in my arms. And wow. Wow. That was, it still gets me. It gets to me every time. Oh, God, I just started screaming, Maddie, she came to me. And there was a big banner in the Helena Airport, "Welcome home, Wilmot." And I went and thanked all the people out there. And we got in the car and went to the Noxheim's home, Bird's Eye Road here in Helena. And Bruce Noxheim, our host father, was the assistant principal at Helena High. And Joyce was a teacher at Bryan Elementary School. And so in the morning, they would go to school, and my wife had arranged with her schoolmate to have the baby with them. And so then I started going to the school with Bruce. And this day I decided to walk around the Helena High. If you know where Helena High is, just in the center of town. And while I was walking, I saw the Capitol building and ran up the front stairs and entered the building. To my right, I saw Office of the Secretary of State. To my left, I saw Office of the Governor. I decided I was going to my left. And as I approached the office, this lady stopped me and said, "Do you have an appointment?" I said, "No, ma'am." She said, "Would you like to make one?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." So I'm writing my name down, and this gentleman comes and said, "May I help you?" I turned to him and said, "No, sir, I'm here to meet the governor." He said, "Well, my name is Mark Roscoe, and I am the governor." I said, "Oh, wow." So I stopped what I was doing. I turned and greeted him. He said, "What can I do for you?" I said, "Well, about 2 weeks ago, I came from Africa, and I thought I should come and meet you." He said, "What part of Africa?" I said, "Liberia." He said, "Oh, where the slaves went." I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Come on in." So I went into his office. And he said, "Mr. Collins, what do you do?" I pull up my resume because I travel with my resume everywhere I went when I came. So I pull up my resume and handed it to him. And he looked it over. And he pressed his intercom and said, "Pat, would you come in?" So Pat Haffey, she used to be Pat Lopatch. She came in and he handed my resume to her and said, "What can we do for Mr. Collins?" And she looked it over and said, "Oh, special ed teacher." I said, "Yes." She said, "Well, Inner Mountain Children's Home is looking for counselors. Why don't you apply and use us as your reference?" I said, "Use the governor as my reference?" He said, "Yes, please, you can use me." He handed me his card. She handed me her card. And I left and applied. I got an interview and I started working 3 weeks after I came to this country and never looked back.
Oh my.
I joined the military, spent 22 years in the military, retire, and you know, in a nutshell, that's what happened.
Oh.
Were you in the Air Force?
No, I spent 14 Army and 8 Navy.
Oh,
that's just epic.
And,
just epic.
And then what led you to the political area other than the governor?
So, that's another story. So I'm home because I was just about 2017, June, I was retiring from the Naval Reserves. And my son was a junior at the University in Missoula, University of Montana. He came home this day and he said, "Dad, I think you should run for political office." I said, whoa, slow down. I know nothing about the political scene in this country. Why would you think I'm qualified to run for office?" He said, "Dad, you are qualified." I said, "Okay, give me 3 reasons why you think I'm qualified." He said, "You know a lot of people know you and you're educated." I said, "Well, those are not reasons, man. Those are not reasons." And he said, "Well, you have a lot of friends. Why don't you invite some of your friends over? And if they don't think you're ready, we can put this aside. We can forget it." I said, okay, I'll take you up on that. So the following week, I invited some friends over for dinner. And they came, three couples. And we had dinner. After dinner, we're sitting down. And I told them, I said, hey, guys, part of the reason you're here is because I'm thinking about running for mayor. And then one of the ladies just yelled out, oh, my God, this is fate. I said, what are you talking about? She said, because we were thinking about asking you. I said, you're kidding me. She said, no. And then my son threw his hand in the air. I rest my case. So that's how the process started.
That's incredible again.
Yeah. And then you were elected what year?
I was elected November 2017. My term started January 2nd of 2018. I'm up for re-election right now.
Right now?
Yeah. November
2nd,
we voted. Yeah, in 4 years.
4 years.
Yeah, it's been 4 years already. Time flies when you're
How's it looking? How's the race looking?
I think it looks pretty good.
All right. Yeah. What does a mayor in Helena do?
Well, you know, maybe similar thing to yours in Bozeman, because it's part-time, but the mayor is the head of the commission. And the mayor is sort of like the tiebreaker for all those votes that go through the commission. And, you know, I chair all the commission meetings, and I'm the face of the commission, so to speak.
Tell me, with all the discussion about immigration, you make the case on why immigration should be much more well accepted and discussed and used, in my opinion, to fill jobs that are just plentiful. I don't know. Do you see it the same way?
Yes. You see, the thing here is most people don't understand the immigration process. And so we tend to get very passionate without understanding what we're passionate about. And I say that to say this. Because we don't know the process, a lot of people, I always tell them refugees are the most vetted immigrants in the world. Because one, refugees are not vetted in the country, in the U.S. Refugees are all vetted in a secondary country. That is, when they flee the country into another country, they become refugees in that country. Like when we fled Liberia, we were refugees in Ghana. And we went through a litany of processes. Most times people tend to link all immigrants together, and I try to tell them, no, it's not the same. Because when you look at asylum seekers, most times asylum seekers will come here, sometimes they come here as visitors. And when it's time for them to go back, they petition the government and say, if I went back, I'll be persecuted. So can I stay? And then they will have to prove their case. But you see, they're proving their case within the U.S. Students come here. They have to be able to show that they can pay for the way, they can pay their way through college. They are not really vetted. Visitors come here. They have to prove that they will be able to go back home and they have business here or whatever it is. They're not really vetted. And refugees are the ones that are vetted outside of the country. And, you know,
yes, we had it.
There's been this.
Yeah.
Excuse me?
No, I was just going to say we had Eamon Fahey, the head of the International Rescue Committee there in Missoula, on a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying it's a really strong process to vet a person before they can enter the United States as a refugee.
Yes, it is. It took me 2 years and 7 months. 2 years and 7 months.
And you almost gave up.
The only thing I was thinking, yes, I didn't almost, I gave up, and my wife was able to convince me to continue. The process is no joke. It's hard. It's invasive. I mean, like all the letters I wrote my wife when she was here, they asked her to send it to them, and they read all through my letters. My most intimate details, my whatever it is, you know, they read all those letters. And it was a tough process. So what I, you know, and most times people tend to say, well, they want to hurt Americans in America. But we rarely know of any such incident where refugees did such. Most times people tend to link things together. The first time I heard, oh, refugees trying to hurt us was the Boston bomber.
Yeah.
You know, the Somaya brothers. And I tried to explain to them, I said, they were not refugees. They came, they were asylum seekers. And it's very difficult trying to differentiate the two, because people don't understand all they know that they were seeking asylum here, so they were seeking refuge, but that's two different things. And so, it's difficult, but when people want to listen, they will listen and they will try to get the right thing. But we have a lot of people who just want to hang on to the lies and the misconception and all of that.
There seems to be a lot of irrational fears that and labeling that goes on without, as you said, without information, without knowledge.
Right. And you know, and sometimes, you know, people tend to latch on to what they know because they are afraid of the unknown. And that's why I always tell fellow refugees and others, I say, you have to tell your story, because if you don't, people will tell it for you and it will be inaccurate. So you have to be able to tell them who you are and let them know who you are and prove to them, you know. And else it just continues. And people tend to be afraid of the unknown. And because they don't know what's happening, they will lash out. So that's why we must always seize the moment as an educational one. Seize the moment as a teachable one to teach someone. And that's why when I was invited to do this, I was happy, because I said, whoa, I'll be able to, I'm sure people will listen to the program. People will gain something from this program. And so, yeah.
You mentioned earlier, and everyone must notice, and it still seems to be the case, when one comes to Montana, you notice that everything seems white. How do you deal with being black in Montana?
You know, I'll be honest with you. I was fortunate to come to Helena, because the way I was received told me, you belong here. Look, I'm not kidding you. We've had our fair share of people not wanting us around. Like when people marked our home with KKK, go back to Africa. But you know, the most amazing thing happened after that happened, the neighbor who got together and washed our walls down. Now, you hear about racism everywhere. Do you hear about that kind of result? Do you hear about that kind of outcome? No, you don't. Only in Helena, Montana. And so when I came back, because I went to call the police, when I came back and saw people washing my wall down, I knew I belong here. I knew Helena was my home.
We're so grateful that you came here, and we're so touched and actually thrilled to hear about the people of Helena and their reception, because changing cultures, I believe, might be one of the harder things human beings ever have to do.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. First of all, just because now in Liberia, our major meal is lunch. This was the first rude awakening I got. Our major meal is lunch, and we eat, our staple food is rice, and we eat a lot of seafood because we border the Atlantic Ocean. And so then I come to Montana, and my wife and I, we go to Staggering Ox the first day, and we had a sandwich, and around 1 o'clock, I'm asking her, so when are we eating lunch? You just ate lunch. I said, no. I mean, our real meal. She said, oh, no. Dinner is the real meal here. Lunch is, you know, something light. I said, you're kidding me. I'm hungry. You know, I want to eat. It was tough for me. Yeah, because I couldn't wait till dinner to eat my major meal. But, you know, so it was crazy. You got to get adjusted. But it took a while. And, of course, the weather, you know, leaving 85 degrees as average temperature and coming to 42 degrees as average temperature is not easy.
That was my next question. How did it go with the weather?
Oh, man. I thank God for long johns. I still wear them.
Yeah.
Yes. I still wear
now
them.
You're...
You know, and then the thing about it, I came with my accent. And, of course, people had to be, they had to listen. And I always had to repeat myself and repeat myself. Thank God I'm not repeating myself as much anymore. So.
Hey, what's happened to your children yet? You mentioned at least two.
Yes, I have two kids. My son, he lives and works in Seattle right now. He works for a nonprofit called Northwest Harvest. My daughter is in the UK with the Navy. My wife is in Texas with the Army. And I'm here.
Oh, your wife is?
Yeah, my wife is also in the Army Reserves. Yes,
uh-huh.
My wife is in the Army Reserves. As a matter of fact, she'll be coming home on the 29th of this month after 1 year of tour in Texas.
Yeah, she's a nurse, is that right?
She's a nurse practitioner now.
Oh.
They sure need that down there.
A lot of COVID cases, yes.
Yes.
I would imagine you run into the different attitudes about vaccinations and masks and all that in Helena like we do here, I guess.
What's that?
You run into all the... talk about whether you should wear a mask or not, or get a shot or not, or at least among a certain group. You probably run into that in your city as well.
Yes. You know, we're not immune from that. But I encourage people, you know, I encourage people to take the vaccine. I've gotten all three. So, you know, I feel relaxed, and I encourage people to take, and I travel with my mask. Just in case anybody's uncomfortable, I do not mind putting on my mask. You know, it's not going to do it. I mean, we studied science from elementary school. Why all of a sudden we're not going to be leading science anymore? We had shots and shots and shots. I know in the military, I didn't even know what kind of shots we were taking. We were just lined up and we were just giving a shot.
Oh, yes.
You know, in boot camp, we just stood there, next, and you just go from station to station and get shot.
All of a sudden, all the ruckus, yeah.
And kids have to take their shots before they can go to school, right? They have to take mumps and measles and all those things. So anyway, but yeah, I believe in the vaccine, and I encourage people to wear their mask when necessary, you know, so yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Can't thank you enough for spending some time with us. That's just an amazing story, going from agony at times and desperation at times to entering a community and actually making a huge contribution. And I think especially in a state that only has 3% variance from the white folks, that we need to be able to meet and greet all of those around us and learn about everyone. And it's just so inspirational. And we really want you to continue in your work.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yes.
Are you going to run for any other offices?
No. It's hard. It's hard. I did a quick stint with the U.S. Senate, and it was difficult. Raising money is no easy feat.
Right.
And then when Governor Bullock got in the race, I dropped out because it took me almost 6 months to raise $300,000, and it took him 2 hours when he got in to raise $1.2
million. Oh, gosh. You know, look at that.
Okay.
I'm going to stick with this term, and hopefully when I do win, that'll be it. I'll do this last term and hopefully retire.
Wow.
Well, perhaps you could think about running for another office one more time after this. We might still need you. In fact,
maybe.
I'm sure we will.
Yeah.
We know that Montana is getting some immigrants. The International Rescue Committee, Suzanne mentioned, they're getting some, I know for sure, in Missoula. I know that there's support here in Bozeman. I don't know about any families coming in, but
and I'm sure you guys know that because of where Missoula is, there is a radius that you must have another agency. Like if Helena wanted to have the refugees come here, we can't because we are within that radius of the International Rescue Committee. And so we can't have another agency here. So there's no way they would place them here. But they could have people here because when you come here, you're here legally. They could have a group of people here who would want to say, oh, we have these facilities. We could help. We could house one or two or three or whatever it is. Individuals can do that, but as an agency, it can't be done. Same thing within Bozeman. You would need another agency to come in, like Church World Service or Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service or Catholic Charity, or you know, one of those nine agencies that have the authority to relocate refugees or resettle refugees.
Yeah, they were gathering different items together, the IRC, to help set these new families just now coming in, the Afghans.
I know, because I came with only one bag. So I know when you come, you're really starting over. Another thing, what I didn't say was when I arrived in the airport, I mean, at the hotel that night, there was a phone booth in the hotel. And I went to the phone booth to see if I could call my family here in Montana from JFK. And the phone booth had, for a 3 minute call, was 35 cents. And when I arrived in at JFK Airport, I had only 25 cents. I could call my family. And then I saw this gentleman in the lobby. And I asked him, I said, hey, would you loan me a dime? He said, I'll never forget. He said, when will I get paid back? I said, okay, excuse me. Would you give me a dime? He said, yeah, sure. He handed me the dime. And I was able to call my family that night. Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Wow. But you made it. It just seems incredible, all that you went through. And you made it. I still have this question. How did your mom do back in Liberia?
Oh, good. Thanks for asking. So my mom eventually came to Montana. She lived with us for about 12 years in Montana.
Good.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
And,
thank goodness.
Then she decided that she wanted to go back. She wanted to go to Minneapolis to live with my sister. I said, oh, my God, Minneapolis is colder than us. You're running from the cold. Why would you want to go to Minneapolis? But she wanted to go because there's a huge Liberian population in Minneapolis.
Oh,
and so my mom is there. she still lives there. As a fact, in August of this year, we celebrated her 90th birthday.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. That's wonderful.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. Thank you.
We have about 3 minutes in the program. Can you summarize for the audience? If someone is an immigrant, what advice would you give to someone just showing up and trying to make it here?
You know, what I will give others is that, you know, just try to get to know them. And I know the only way we can alleviate our fears is to talk about it and get to know the people we're supposed to be afraid of. Talk to them, hear their story. And you will realize that, no, I don't think they're here to harm me, but rather they're here, they fled that war that you think they want to start here. No, they don't want to start that war here. They want to start anew. And they want that second chance. The only way they can get that second chance is if you would talk to them, listen to them, learn their story. They're willing to talk about it. But don't shun them.
Just interact. Don't be critical.
Yes,
don't be judgmental. Listen.
Yeah. Just interact.
It sounds like just basic humanity, Mayor Collins.
Yes. That's it. That's it. You're right. And I really appreciate you guys having me on. And when I come to Bozeman one of these days, I'll look you up.
Oh, we would love that.
Excellent.
Be sure to do that.
We'd like to come to Helena and say hello to you.
Yes, when you're in Helena, give me a call. You have my number.
I do. Well,
okay.
This was truly an inspiring trip. We feel like we took the journey with you, Mayor Collins, and we just really can't thank you enough for sharing really the glory of that story and the glory of the Helena community.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I
live
in a beautiful...
You'll be happy. When you get your family back together, your wife is coming back soon. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Friday. She'll be here on Friday. Yeah.
Another nice homecoming.
Yes.
Well, we wish you luck in your election bid. I know there's a mayoral and commission election here as well coming up. So everybody get out and vote. And even though it's not supposed to be a political program, I can say something for you. I hope you get elected again.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. All right.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very, very
you
much.
Bet. No
Take
problem.
Care.
Thank you. Yep.
Good night.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. So we like to say to the audience, feel free to go to kgvm.org and look up this program right away. Listen to it again. Frankly, I like it so much listening to Mayor Collins. I'm going to listen to it again. And I rarely do that. But I think his story is compelling and so beautiful and so scary. And it's turned out very, very well. So I would urge all of you to follow his example with his persistence, goodwill, grace, and love of other people. I think that is such a good model. Thank you for listening tonight. And come back next week and listen to KGVM 95.9 FM or go to kgvm.org. And we wish you a good night.